Welcome to the class Inspiring to Write, lighting a fire beneath our students to produce people excited about writing. I feel like my introduction is a bit like a Sherlock Holmes story. There are a whole bunch of pieces, and you have to wait till the end to see if it fits together. Problem is, I'm not Sherlock Holmes. So if it doesn't fit together at the end of the introduction, it's my fault and not yours. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. The same was in the beginning with God. All things were made by Him. And we see that in the beginning, God created story. Story is about creation. Story is about writing it down. God created story, and He wrote it down for us. He took a man, and He took a woman, and He thought up the most beautiful setting imaginable, and He placed them in there. In spite of the villain, the worst villain imaginable, and He let His characters go. He let them choose. And when they chose darkness, when the villain ruled, He didn't stop. He created a character, a hero, the most magnificent hero Himself, actually. And that hero walked right into the very teeth of the dragon to snatch the man and the woman back for Himself. Again, only on the man and the woman's choice. John calls that hero the Word. In his book, Teaching That Transforms, John D. Roth says that the primary theological difference between Mennonites and mainstream Christianity is their interpretation of the incarnation of Christ. That if Mennonites hope to not be assimilated into mainstream Christianity, they had better emphasize this particular doctrine, this particular aspect of Christ. Why? Because when the Word was made flesh, when Christ was made flesh, incarnate, and dwelt among us, we beheld His glory. His glory. The glory as of the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth. In the incarnation, the Word became practical. The Word became flesh that we could see, that we could understand. Through the incarnation, we could finally get it. When Christ was willing to come and put on flesh and walk and live it, then we say, "Now I understand. Now it makes sense." And He showed us that it's actually possible to live according to God's Word. That He expects us to actually take up our crosses and follow. He expects us, God expects us to move beyond obedience in our heads to actual obedience in our hearts and our hands. So the incarnation, the idea that God wanted to get across to us, His law, His Word, was too much. Too much for us to grasp until He would come Himself and live it and show us the way. Now, why John D. Roth makes this point in the book is because he's accusing mainstream Christianity of saying, "I believe it, I got it with my head," but whenever you watch what their hands are doing, they're not being Christ. And so that's why he says we need to emphasize this. Why all this when the subject is inspiring to write? Because it answers for us the why of writing. Why am I writing? The objective of every good story, I believe, should be one thing, to incarnate truth. Even Jesus, that incarnate Word, used the Word. He spoke in parables so that His listeners could better understand the truths He was trying to get across. You see, we have some concept, some truth that is kind of a mystery. It's in darkness. It's hard to grasp. And the good story is one that turns the lights on. And it illuminates, and we're able to see something finally that we've not been able to articulate or see before. The Word was made flesh and dwelt among us that we could better see the Father. And you and I know that stories have shaped our world. Stories have had their place in your life, in mine. We're kind of living stories. And stories serve so well at incarnating truth, at shaping our world, influencing us. For several reasons. They arrest our attention, first of all. Wherever stories are told, people gather to listen. You have the stories of the old gray-bearded storytellers around the fire in ages past. Now the people come together and listen. And it still happens today. This past March, I was at REACH, which is Faith Builders' kind of mission conference thing. And there was a storyteller there, Leroy Hirschberger. Some of you might know him. And he tells stories. And he had three classes throughout the day. And his first class was maybe about the size of this one. His next class was about twice as big, and his last class about three times as big. People gravitated there because stories were being told. Stories are memorable, much easier to remember. It's much easier to remember an incident than to remember the exact wording of the Constitution. And stories are permanent. When they're written down, they're preserved. God wrote his story down, and it remains for us today. To summarize, writing is the act of transferring the nebulous into the experienced, using a character outside of ourselves to illustrate reality and thereby illuminate that part of ourselves that our own eyes have difficulty seeing. And the object of the storyteller should be to capture truth. And when well written, that story is attractive, memorable, and permanent. Now, how can we inspire to write? I had a topic in February about compositions, and much of these are exactly what I share there. So if it doesn't quite fit, understand. But I think there's a lot of applications. We're just going to go straight into it. How can we write? Because that's pretty key. The setting, some things. Read good books and good stories, and that's why I brought Les Mis along. Short stories, characters in conflict. This is my favorite short story in The Scarlet Ibis by James Hurst. It's the best short story you're going to read. And you need to read it to your students because it shakes their worlds and makes them wake up to some truth. You can read it yourself and find out. Sometimes read a good story and then ask your students, what elements of that story do you feel like you could not have written? You know, as soon as they're all excited about it, then I say, wait, do you think you could have written that story? Like, do you understand enough about whatever it is, some little town in the West? No, maybe not. But a lot of the good stories we read, there's nothing that in our knowledge, our understanding of people or of actual things that we can't write about. So it empowers us to actually do it. So read. That's a good setting, a good starting place. And push reading. Talk about Les Mis. This book, again, I offered my students. I said, hey, I can't read you this whole book this school year. It is here on my desk. If you want to borrow it, take it home and read it. And sure enough, one of the ninth graders took it home this past year, and her brother that's out of school, he met me later. He said, I'm two-thirds the way through Les Miserables, and I can't lay it down. I was so excited. I said, actually, you can have that book. It's a gift to you. Push that. Somehow get them to read. I'd picked up other books over the years and let my students read it. One of the students' dads very kindly went through and marked out all the bad words and gave the book back. So you run that risk, but do push reading. Another part about the setting is take time to smell the roses. Be an observer. Make your class stop and watch the fox that's making his way across the hillside. Make them crouch down and inspect the first flowers of spring. Make them measure how far the beans grew over the weekend. And ask them what they think about North Korea and what's going to happen. And make them take time to smell the roses, open up their eyes and be aware. A good writer needs to be a good observer. Also take time sometimes to shake their perspectives, because so much about attractive writing is taking an old thing and looking at it from a new perspective. So make them view America through the lens of a North Korean and say, suppose your dad, your hometown was bombed in World War II to nothing. How would you feel about the US of A? Make them view North America through the eyes of a Syrian refugee. Just change their perspective. Another thing you can do is write yourself and showcase your own writing, not proudly, but candidly, with an anyone can do this mentality. I think it can be done and can very much inspire students to write. I remember when I wrote a story about a skunk that we picked up by the tail, and I read that to my class after I'd written it, and first of all, I should back up and say, I wrote this because they were writing, so I'm going to write too. So we wrote together, so that's a good thing to do. And then I read the story to them, and I still remember that sixth grader who was right where the skunk was, almost in my hand, or my brother's hand. That sixth grader was out of his desk like this, just, and whenever that thing was caught, there's a big sigh goes across the room. And if that's not rewarding, I really enjoy that. This past year, on Good Friday, I got an email in my inbox with a painting of the Passion of the Christ, like I've never seen a painting before. And I sat down and started crying, and within an hour I'd written a poem, and I took it Monday morning, and I said, how was your weekend? And they talked about their weekend, and I said, I wrote a poem, and I read them my poem, and I could see the one 10th grader, his eyes just lit up, and it's a bit of a wow factor there. Not that it's something special or spectacular, but that it's being done, and it can be done. And that's actually why I wrote this up here, is to put in a little bit of a plug. If you want to get a poem in your inbox every week that's written by poets like my friends and I, or by you if you want to submit them, go here, sign up, or talk to me, and you can do that, because then you'll have poetry that's being written by real Anabaptist people today. It's a good thing that's happening. Also, be so excited. And that's why I put the Windhover. I think it's on your outline. This is Gerd Manley Hopkins. I missed his name, and that is a grave mistake. And he says himself that this is his favorite poem that he wrote. He dedicates it to Christ our Lord. We're talking poetry in English class this year. This was on my chalkboard, and the students saw me get more excited than I was a lot of the year about this poem, because it is so beautiful. I caught this morning's minion, kingdom of daylight dauphin, dappled, dawn-drawn falcon in his riding, of the rolling level underneath him, steady air and striding. High there, how he rung upon the rein of a wimpling wing in his ecstasy, then off, forth on swing, as a skate's heel sweeps smooth on a bow bend, the hurling gliding rebuffed the big wind. My heart is hiding, stirred for a bird, the achieve of, the mastery of the thing. Brute beast and valor in act, oh, air, pride, plume, here, buckle, and the fire that breaks from thee then a billion times lovelier, more dangerous, oh, my chevalier. No wonder of it, sheer plod makes plow down Cilian, shine and blue bleak embers, ah, my dear, fall, gall themselves, and gash gold vermilion. Don't ask me what it means. I know a little bit what it means. I know the feeling I get when I read it, and that's what poetry is all about. There's assonance and alliteration in there, and many good things that you can talk to your students about. Be so excited, it's going to catch on. Some tools. Use the power of joy. It kind of has to do with being excited, but just do it. Just require it of the students. When lunchtime comes around, everyone seems to have plenty to say. And why can't they also write it? And we all love telling stories. If you teach, you know that you've got one or two storytellers in your room that just won't stop talking, especially if it's off subject. And it's time for him to write it down. Why not write them? Another way to use the power of joy is read them. Read good stories. I probably read my students' short stories for about half of the story times this past year, ones that they really enjoyed. Secondly, use the power of props. Big problem with writing is what to write about. So create some props, something they can base their writing from. Use pictures. Norman Rockwell is a perfect one. So if you have some Norman Rockwell paintings or pictures, say, write about what happened in this picture. Make this maybe the climax of your story. Use characters in their own lives. If you teach Rotten Staff English, you run into this. And respectfully, but use characters in their own lives. Use a history or geography of your own community. See if you can find up some old story and get them to write about it. It's already been told, but they can write about it from their own perspective. A good one would be D.B. Cooper. So what happened with D.B. Cooper, and what is the story? Well, there's enough of a skeleton there that we do know that you could easily create something fascinating from that. In our area there at home, we had John Torno is his name, an outlaw that finally got himself killed. Innocently, maybe, maybe not. Take those kind of incidents, local lore, and tell enough to your students, and then get them to kind of write about it. It breaks that not knowing. Use the power of props. Get them past that first 50% of just deciding what to write about. Also, use the Bible. This is very, very useful. I've used it every year. To take a Bible story and write it in your own words. And if you need a good resource for places where this is done already, look at Manner to Jung. You know that man that wrote The Wheel in the School and Shadrach and Singing. I forget all the books he wrote. But there's a book, The Mighty Ones, which is Old Testament Bible stories written in language we can understand and connect with interesting little twists. It's worthwhile getting a hold of. And your students can try to copy De Jong with that. Write also about what you know. Don't let them write about places far away and people in old days too much. Write about what you know. Number three, the power of connection. A good writer needs to learn to enter into the story themselves. Use the five senses, the five avenues by which our minds receive stimulus. So if I want my reader to experience this story, I need to sit myself in the story and think about what I want that reader to hear, see, smell, taste, touch. Got them. I need to put those things in there, because if there's no sensory information coming from the story, the reader's not going to receive any senses, and he's not going to get it. This is where the writing by Philip Dunn, I think it's also on the back of your handout, comes in. I'm going to read it. Are there underlined parts in there in your handout? Good, good, good. Pay special attention to them. Writing by Philip Dunn. This is from the book 32 Third Graders in One Class. Bunny, a very good book. Boys and girls, I announced, today we're going to learn how to write. Justin groaned. Then I said, now put on your coat, put your coats and hats on, we're going outside. Yeah, they all screamed. But there's one rule, I said. You must not say one word when we go outside. Got it? They smiled and nodded with their mouths closed. We put on our coats and hats and lined up. Then we walked outside in single file to an open field right next to our school. No one spoke. We sat down in the grass, closed our eyes, and listened to children shout in the distant playground. We lay down on our backs and took big breaths and tried to smell the wetness of autumn. We watched golden leaves say goodbye to branches and follow their paths to the ground. We waited for the leaves to fall on our faces. It began to drizzle. They all looked at me, expecting me to say, it's time to go back inside. We didn't. The children looked at each other with wide eyes. We took our hats off instead and tried to catch raindrops in our mouths. They were dying to speak, but no one did, for they knew it would break the spell. Okay, everyone, I said, let's walk back to class. We kicked rocks and crunched leaves on our way back to school. We slipped in mud and splashed in puddles. We felt the cold autumn earth through our shoes. Finally, we walked inside, took off our coats, wiped our feet, and hung up our hats. Everyone sat down. They all looked at me. Peter raised his hand. His lips were held tight. Yes, Peter, I said. You may speak now. He let out a big sigh and put his hands down. Mr. Dunn, he said, when are we going to learn to write? I smiled. You just did, Peter. You just did. The underlying parts in there, like listen to the children shout, that's what they would have heard. Smell the wetness, they're smelling. Watch the golden leaves, they're seeing something. Waited for the rain to fall on our faces. You're beginning to feel it there. The raindrops in our mouth. We even got a little bit of taste in this. Not that you as a character are going to necessarily feel that, but you see what he did. Put his students out there and let them experience it. And then they're equipped to go write about what they experienced. But you need to make sure you get the five senses in there in order to make a story attractive. So ask your students to enter into a Bible story. Here we're back to the Bible thing. And think about what the main character would have taken in through these channels, through his five senses. And then when he writes, he enables the reader to experience the story with him. So let's do a little bit of that. The setting is Joseph being carried to Egypt by the Ishmaelites. What are some things he might see?
Dust.
More. Just call them out.
Probably shimmering heat waves.
Heat waves. Okay, what might he smell?
Camels.
Leather.
Well, the smells of going from one environment to the other, it's always going to be different smells.
good. Maybe you'll notice some strange food smells. What might he hear?
Well, the camel's feet.
Camel's feet.
Foreign language.
Foreign language.
Hawks.
Maybe his chains clanking together. What might he taste?
Warm water.
Warm water.
Sweat.
Sweat.
He might even taste fear.
Fear. Taste it. Maybe there's some blood in his mouth. Maybe he'll taste the new food again. And what might he feel?
Scared.
Panic.
Rejection.
He's going to feel his chains right here. He's going to feel his sweat under his collar. He's going to feel that swaying camel. I think if you ask those five questions, then you're equipped to write the story. So your students need to do that. They need to think about what he would see, smell, taste, hear, and feel, and then they're equipped to write about those things. They need to include that his collar was sticky on his neck, and that he heard the chains clanking together, and that he saw the dust and those things. That's really is the selling point of any story. A story that we can't sense anything in is a dead story. Fourthly, use the power of the concrete. Not such an important thing, but it is. Give the reader something to hold in his hand. If the reader looks in a nest, if the main character looks in a nest and it's empty, that's one thing. But wouldn't it be so much better if he looks in the nest and there's just one small blue feather? It's not empty, but to me it suddenly becomes more empty because of what's there and what isn't there. He's looking for eggs, of course. And he looks in and there's just a blue feather. It's like, what a poor replacement. So put something concrete, then he can hold that feather in his hand. He has something to get a hold of. It wasn't just an emptiness. The reader's going to end up holding that feather as evidence in his mind as he reads. Also use exact words, and it's kind of elementary, but something is always better than anything. Skipping is better than running. Snoring is better than sleeping. Apple pie is better than dessert. And Chevy is better than truck. Use exact verbs and prepositions and be precise with your writing. Use the power of the concrete. Students should also use the power of the unavoidable climax. We know what the climax is. It's a high point in the story where the truth wins and the lesson comes home to us. Or else maybe the main character fails drastically. It's a tragedy. But so much more important, actually, than the climax is the build-up. It's how we get there. And so we should understand a concept that choices always force more choices. In life, we never made one choice, and that was the last choice we made. Oh, we do. We make a choice to follow Christ, and then we never look back. Well, exactly, but you know what happens? That choice is tested and tested and tested. And it seems that every test we pass, there comes a harder one down the line. Choices force more choices. Specifically, if you choose wrong, so you choose to do something small, something bigger comes along, you know that. And then something bigger and something bigger, and the thing keeps snowballing. Make sure that your climax is that way, that you start with some small mistake in the story, and then you grow on something bigger, and then something bigger. And if possible, make these, in fact, unavoidable, to where there's, because he chose this, he's going to have to face this other decision. You know, once you look at the candy bar and wonder whether you should steal it or not, and then you choose to steal it, of course you're going to have to decide, are you going to lie now whenever someone asks you about it? And force them, if possible, into a greater climax. It's called the snowball effect, if you can implement it. It's not always easy. God's story is a bit that way, for sure. The choices that Adam and Eve made create choices for us. So, how can we just do it? Number six, the procedure, getting it done. What is a way to just get it done? Make the students do it. And I use the 8th grade English book. I wrote that in here because I was teaching with the 8th grade English book. And this thing is very, very useful. And one of the lessons you will find, I think it's written out for you, this theme, conflict, conclusion, main character. One of the lessons says, plan this out like this if you want to write a story. And just because it's the English book and the students think it's boring does not mean it's wrong. It works very, very well. And if possible, do something just like it said up here with your students, write real time in class. This is what I used last year. And by the time class was finished, the students were all pulling out their scribblers and writing down what I had so that they could write a story. And of course, no, you have to make your own. Oh, really? Can't we just change the main character? No, you have to make your own. But I was glad one of them wrote it down, because then when I was ready to give the talk, I could go look at their scribbler and remember what I had on the board. So this is what it went, some things to do. And I'm going to jump down to D, the main character. First of all, let's choose the main character and name him Bob. That's very easy. Now I'm jumping back up to the theme. What lesson do we want to teach with the story? The first thing to think about. And we decided to teach the theme that procrastination and laziness is a bad habit that must be conquered. I can identify well with that, as the students could. That's a good theme to talk about. So then we need to think about, I'm going to jump back down to Bob again, and we're going to think about his appearance or his character, and these need to be in line with a lesson we're going to teach. Of course, Bob is going to be the one who fails in this story until he finally wins. So his appearance is going to be disarrayed. His shoes are going to be untied. His bedroom is a mess. His character is lazy and indifferent, and yet he's pushy and confident, because that's the way those people can be. They pretend like a lot's happening when nothing is. The conflict is kind of like the last incident, but we're going to make Bob's laziness give him a run-in with the law. So first of all, we chose the main character, then we think, what lesson are we going to teach? And now, where is the big conflict that we can have this fella win or lose under? And then you think backwards. What are smaller conflicts that we can set this thing out? It's best if you can start out your story, in fact, in the middle of conflict is a great idea. So incident one is that Bob stays up later than he intended the previous evening because he's shining his truck. He's very proud of his truck, and he gets all polished, but he runs way past his bedtime. Not really a conflict, and yet you can see that things are happening that are not good, so we're setting him up for something. Incident two, of course, he was out washing his truck, taking so much care of it, that he pushes the snooze too many times in the morning, and he is behind schedule. And this thing is not original with me. My students, they thought up all these ideas. So he pushes the snooze too many times. He's behind schedule. So now his shiny truck is behind schedule. Incident three, he rushes off to work and accidentally runs over his mom's rose bush because, I don't know, he took the corner out the drive or something, and he hit his mom's rose bush. So, of course, he didn't stop and apologize to her, but it's really weighing on his mind. Or, of course, you can work this anyway. You can make him stop and apologize to her, and it would be a good time for her to very gently remind him, Bob, your procrastination and pushing the snooze too much is getting you in trouble, isn't it? Of course, his mom's going to respond that way. And it's a good time to drive the lesson home a little bit more. But, of course, he doesn't respond well at all. It's pshaw and kafooey. She doesn't know what she's talking about. Another thing, the students thought that he had to run over his RC car because he was up the night before also running his remote control car around. And he just let it behind his truck, didn't see it, backed out in the drive, smashed it. And, of course, it was $400. And that's going to make him upset. So incident four, he's late for work and he gets stopped for speeding on the way to work and his insurance is out. Now, I don't know what insurance is like here in Oregon, but in BC, if your insurance is out, you can't even license your vehicle without insurance. So it's a very big deal if your insurance is out. So, the conclusion, Bob pays the fine or he gets his truck out of impound and he learns the lesson. Now, you're used to the story. So he paid the fine and he felt very sorry, and Bob will never do this again. Very conclusive, and we're convinced, not at all, because we don't know if he will. The way you need to do this is Bob pays the fine, or he gets his truck out of impound, and 2 weeks later, he opens up an envelope that his car insurance is out, and he pays it right away. Much better way to end a story. And I got stories back from my students. Of course, they were all still about breaking the law and shooting a deer, poaching a deer out of season, or shooting a four-point instead of whatever. But the main was about shooting a buck in doe season or something. And the law came in and caught the fella, and on his way home the very next day or something, he sees a real nice buck in the field, but he just turns the other way and goes on home. It's a little bit better, at least. It's more convincing. So show that the main character learned his lesson. That right there is the crux of what I've got to share. If you want to inspire to write, your students usually just need something to get them started with. And besides all the other inspiring things, just to do it. This is a bulletproof plan. Anyone can create a story following these steps, and it will be interesting enough. Some spice, some more things to think about. The power of the cumulative. Number 7, Brooks Landon in his course, this is from The Great Courses, Building Better Sentences, Exploring the Writer's Craft. He talks about the power of the cumulative sentence. And the basis of it is somewhat like this, that we have a base clause, and then you're familiar, of course, with dependent clauses. Let's go ahead and put all this business on there. And I hope that you're familiar with diagrams and dependent clauses. If you aren't, you should be. And you can keep hanging things off here, and you can work these on down. I need to think these through a little bit, or else I'm going to diagram something way wrong and look like I don't practice what I preach. But this, the dependent clauses all need the base clause. So the base clause is your kernel thing, and then build more and more clauses on that to keep the conflict rolling. One of the great lines in here was exactly that. I didn't realize until I was partway through reading it. Listen to this sentence. It's all one sentence. They remained motionless in this cave, in this blackness, under this timber almost hung, forced to monstrous exertions to reach their bread or their pitcher, the arch above their heads, the mud up to their knees, their excrement running down their legs, collapsing with fatigue, their hips and knees giving way, hanging by their hands to the chain to rest, unable to sleep except standing, and constantly woken up by the strangling of the collar. Some did not wake up. There he put his base clause pretty much. The punchline is at the end of that one, which is super good too. But that was one whole sentence and not a whole bunch of independent clauses. You need one or two maybe independent clauses. Keep everything else dependent on it so that your thought never quite ends and you keep rolling the snowball along. Do I have the wolf leaped on your handout? I think so. Here's a little one that I did. The wolf leaped accurately, snarling, lunging out of the darkness, knocking the unsuspecting boy down in the snow, smothering his face with friendly caresses. Notice those were gerunds. ING, 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 ING. So we're keeping the whole thing from actually ending. Brooks Landon's favorite sentence in the course, obviously, is he drove the car carefully, and I'm not going to be able to remember, but it goes something like this. He drove the car carefully, his hair blown in the wind, wraparound sunglasses hiding his face. This and this and this, the revolver on the seat beside him, the corpse stuffed in the trunk. And he starts out with him driving the car carefully, and you're just aware that the car's being driven carefully. When it comes to the end, you realize why the car is driven carefully, and it creates a very satisfying sentence. It's sports writing is very much this way. So if we took the clause, the girl screamed, as a base clause, and see if we can do this a little bit. The girl screamed, and now think about maybe reasons why she's screaming or things that are happening, and I wonder if you could create any. I'm going to give you about a minute or two. You could do something like this. Her hair blown in the wind, her face pale and white, dot. You get the feel? And then wind it up. And use INGs, maybe. Does anyone have any they'd like to share? Austin, could I pick on you? Do you have one?
I do, actually.
Could you read it for us?
I have. The girl screamed, both hands waving, eyes open wide. The high trouble was ringing off the wall as a $40 rushed to answer.
Good, good. Those are pretty good. Anyone else? Mm-hmm.
The girl screamed, her head thrown back in terror, whites strung around her eyes, her fingernails digging into her palms as a spider creeped up her leg.
Perfect. Good. It's the only one of the spider hunts he was talking about earlier, probably. I did. The girl screamed, hands reaching forward, toes tingling, her heart at half beat, breath tight, the whole world rushing up to meet her. We talked about February, taking something out in the middle of February and doing something. Do this with your students instead of English class. Make them create cumulative sentences. Good base clauses. The girl screamed, the fire raged, the wolf leaped. Anything like that with a little bit of motion in it. And then do the rest of it. The skier did something. And create continued clauses on that to create a cumulative sentence. Let's use the power of the figurative. Write in poetry. How to say this, whether this exactly ties in here, but I had a student this past year that was running a small debate with me about prophecy, and he talked about how his perspective is just taking the Bible for what it says, and I try to stay out of those kind of discussions, but I asked him whether he's a sheep, because the Lord is our shepherd, and we are his sheep. So you see, the Bible is full of figurative language, very, very much of it. In fact, there's things like similes. The same hour the thing was fulfilled upon Nebuchadnezzar, he was driven from mat, did eat grass. His body was wet with the dew. His hairs were grown like eagle's feathers, and his nails like bird's claws. So there's some similes. There's the metaphor, the Lord is my shepherd. The personification. Princes shall come out of Egypt. Ethiopia shall stretch out her hands unto God. And the other one is a hyperbole. And I'm not sure this is a hyperbole, so I share this with a grain of salt, but it's easier for a camel to go through the eye of the needle than for a rich man to enter into the kingdom of God, I think perhaps could be a hyperbole. You have to be careful with saying that the Bible is full of hyperbole. But teach your students to use metaphors specifically. Often I've seen compositions that were really good and they were clear full of similes, but there can be way too many similes, and see if they can change it into her face looked like a dinner bowl. Her face just was a dinner bowl. And it's more effective. Did you want to share something? Okay, it's a stretchy yawn. Questions coming in a little bit. Poetry, to talk about writing poetry or inspire students to write poetry, I'm not sure how that's going to work out for you. To me, it seems that most students actually don't have mature enough minds to write poetry. Say it carefully, but there's something about being able to see something for not what it is, but for what it actually is. Not what it's seen as, but what it is. That might come with a little more age. But yet, I know of teachers that are creating really good poems with their middle, lower grade students. Marilyn F. Martin is one. She does really well with her students in creating poetry. I don't have a lot of answers for that. Somehow I'll get your students to see if they can begin to feel rhyming words. I've had way too many that ask me, what is a rhyming word? And does this rhyme with this? If English isn't their first language, I'll give you a little bit of a break. But a good thing you can do is have your dad read To Think That I Saw It on Mulberry Street. He read that to us a lot. Read Dr. Seuss. It will teach your children's students poetry. Also, due dates. I think that if you're going to inspire to write, your students need to get some time to get that inspiration in there. So I wouldn't assign it and make it due the next day. I like to assign it and say, think about it, throw out a whole bunch of ideas. And then, of course, 2 days later, you need to say, are you thinking about it? Or else they're not thinking about it. And get them to see if they can talk to each other. And then after time, slowly, I usually extend a composition for a story might be 2 weeks or 3 weeks until that thing's actually due and needs to be handed in. Because these things cannot be forced or created. Are there questions?
Mm-hmm. What's the difference? I mean, how can you tell between making an interesting sentence and being wordy?
Good question. It's the difference between a writer and a poet. Well, I don't know which is which either. I don't know. And so you're probably thinking in light of the cumulative sentence and how long they are. This fella says that it's not really necessarily how long they are, but how they're made long, like this. And so if you can keep one base clause, you can run a long sentence, it'll still be interesting. But you for sure don't want every sentence to be like that. Short sentences are very powerful. But short sentences are overused by contemporary novelists like crazy. You've all read those books. They have a nice big paragraph, and then you have a three-word sentence, and then you have the next paragraph. And that's an old technique, I think a cheap technique. I think there's just gotta be a better way. More questions? Those are very good. In conclusion, a writer's work is going to be valued in proportion to the quality of light it sheds on truth. So we need to be well acquainted with the truth, the word. The teacher, you're the primary inspirer. And don't hesitate to dig a little deeper into the word to understand what truth really is, because truth has universal appeal. And this is where stories can make a difference in our world today. I was on a flight. Flying into Baltimore late one night. It was Southwest, and I got on the plane and got to sit in the very front along the window. And a lady came in and sat down along the aisle, and she turned on her reading light and opened up a book. And she said, "I hope you don't mind the light." I said, "I appreciate the light. It's nice to see you reading a book instead of a Kindle." And she said, "Yeah, you need to have the feel in it." And so we started talking about writing, and she was flying to Baltimore for a class she was taking about Shakespeare. And we got in this writing discussion. She said, "Do you write?" I said, "Yeah, I write." And she said, "What do you write?" I said, "Poetry mostly." "Well, what kind of poetry?" I wasn't sure what the question really meant, but I said, "Sacred poetry. I'm a Christian, and I care about the truth. And so I write about it unashamedly because I believe that Christianity is the only true religion, and that truth in Christianity will appeal to any other religion. So I don't need to be ashamed of writing truth because it has a universal appeal." And she just nodded her head, said, "That makes sense to me." So we need to make sure our stories portray truth, because that's where we're going to get the buy-in. Truth strikes that place in everyone's heart. Its appeal is universal. May we choose to write, inspire to write, and by writing, share the Christ we know with our readers, that very Christ may be glorified. May our compositions bear witness of the light, that all men through him might believe. Thank you.